I didn't bring my handkerchiefs. So. I'm so pleased to be here, and this is unusual. This for me is unusual in almost every way, to be introduced by my dad, to be speaking in this sort of space. I'm so happy to be here. I spend a lot of time talking with parents, with youth development professionals, about young people and their development and their well-being. And really, I was just talking with Tim last night, only in just the last few years, really maybe last 18 months maybe, has the issue of faith started coming up in all the conversations I have. There is really a deep yearning to talk about these issues. I'm really pleased to be here. I've talked with this is my second time to come to speak in a specific with a group that has specifically come together around thinking about the role of faith in the lives of young people, and specifically in the lives of sexual minority LGBT young people. So thank you for inviting me. Do I need to... Is that helping? Say something. Will that work? Louder? The other challenge is that I'm soft-spoken, so if you will nod appropriately when you either can or cannot hear me, that would be good. Thanks. So, and I've got this high-tech thing. What I want to talk about today is understanding same-sex sexuality among adolescents in context, in the context, and specifically then focus on faith as one of the most critical contexts for understanding young people in their development. And then talk with you about some results from research I've been doing with the National Longitudinal Study of Adolescent Health. I want to acknowledge that the work is supported by the William T. Grant Foundation, which is terrific, and I have a number of graduate students who have worked with me at UC Davis on this project. Anna Morocco is a person who deserves a lot of thanks for the work on religion. And I did make handouts, but I'm glad to provide those to anyone who asks me afterwards, and I think I'll work a deal with Jan to have them available here at the seminary. So my focus today is really going to be on emotional health of sexual minority young people. I think what we know, the big picture of adolescent sexual orientation, what we know is that sexual minority young people, LGBT young people, are at risk for the most compromising challenges that we know of today in the lives of young people. You name it, and LGBT young people, studies will show that LGBT young people are at risk for substance use and abuse, for depression and anxiety, for other kinds of risk-taking behaviors, and of course most of us have probably heard the statistics about youth suicide among LGBT young people. And I think the challenge for us is to understand why that is. I've been one of the people that has been writing a lot, documenting risk in the lives of sexual minority young folks, and I'm also one of the people that's kind of done with talking about risk and is really interested in trying to locate that risk and see what we can do about it. And I think that one of the exciting things is that there's this interest in talking about what role the church can play in doing something about it. I thought I'd start out a little bit, and I know that I'm speaking to the choir in some ways, But I wanted to talk a little bit about understanding sexual orientation in adolescence. And so for some of you, this is, you've been there, and you know what this is about, and for others, maybe this will be useful new information. But sexual orientation, when we talk about that, when I use that, sexual orientation is a consistent pattern of sexual or affectional or emotional feelings, emotional and romantic feelings or fantasies. It's an inner sense of who I am as a person. And it should be distinguished from sexual behavior and sexual identity, which are two other dimensions that that we often confuse, and we often talk about sexual preference, sexual identity, sexual orientation in ways that are confusing. We don't distinguish between them. But sexual identity is claiming a same-sex identity, saying that I am gay, I am lesbian, I am bisexual, I am transgender. And then sexual behavior, of course, is the behavior that we engage in with the people that we love and care about. And the point of this graphic, which I hope some of you were duly impressed with since it took me a while to figure out how to do it, is that these are non-overlapping. The research in this field is very confusing because we have studies of gay kids, we have studies of kids who've engaged in same-sex behavior, we have studies of kids who have a same-sex sexual orientation. And really what's not mapped on here is gender identity, which is a whole other dimension, which may be a third dimension that could come out this way, perhaps. So I want to just clarify that language and perhaps, and maybe for some of you, give you a new way to think about these ideas and the ways that they overlap in young people's lives. And it'll make a difference when we talk about the research. Most of the research that we have has been based on samples of young people that claim a same-sex identity. But those are that research has been challenged in a number of ways that I can talk about. When we think about the important context, I'm a sociologist. Whoa, this got loud. That's good, thanks. If that's too loud, let me know. I think a lot about the context of development for adolescents, and I've got another graphic here, and I hope that the black text shows up. But essentially, there's a young person, you have the life of a young person, and in childhood, and maybe we can think about going around the room here, in childhood, this might be a stereotype where the life of a young person is completely encompassed by their family, school peers, and there's the faith context that plays a role there. And I think that what happens when we think about adolescence is that the young people develop in the context of a larger environment, their community, the town they live in, their neighborhood. And during adolescence, that environment literally grows around them. You become exposed to a much wider possibility of what the world might be. That happens, some other key changes start going on in the lives of kids, and I think one of the important ones that happens in our context is that some of these important overlapping places where we nurture and care for young people break apart in some ways, not always in negative ways, but I think in this would be a stereotypical representation where in adolescence the parents, the family, the siblings may not be connected to school anymore. And in fact, there's a lot of debate among folks who are concerned with the educational environment that actually there's an intentional break at junior high school where, at least in the community where I live, there's an intentional effort to get parents to not be connected to the junior high school. And in this example, this young person has friends at school, has some friends outside of school, some friends at church that goes to church with the family. There are all sorts of other kinds of environments that young people live in. There's another really important one that I think is playing a big role today, and that's the media. And I illustrated here as a filter through which we kind of understand ourselves and see the world. And this is a really important filter for young people. And for those of you who are interested in or have any facility in understanding the internet and the role of media in the lives of kids, we as adults really are just way behind, and it's hard for us to even grasp the importance and meaning of what's going on with young people's experiences of the media and how that shapes the way they understand their faith, the way they understand themselves as young people and their sexualities. My point in showing this is not only to show that I can do really cool things with PowerPoint. The important point here is that each of these fundamental, the most important developmental settings in the lives of young people today, their schools, families, peers, and faith communities, none of these critical developmental settings are equipped today to understand and deal with same-sex sexuality in the lives of young people. None of them. We are living in a world where young people are coming out at younger and younger ages. They're coming out in the context of their family, schools, and churches, and these are institutions that simply don't know. I've never had to deal with this before. The teachers in today's public schools were not trained at a time when it was conceivable that young people would come out. The people who are leading our congregations went to church as kids when it was just not even within the realm of possibility that a teenager would be gay, lesbian, bisexual, or transgender. And so I think that the challenge for me in my work is to figure out how we can understand these critical contexts and how we can then support the key players in those contexts to make a difference in the lives of young people as they understand their emerging sexuality. So what do we know about sexual orientation in adolescence? Well, sexual orientation, identity, and behavior develop during adolescence. It's the most compelling, exciting, frightening, terrifying thing for adults, right, about adolescence. It's compelling and exciting for everybody, for young people, for their families, for the adults that care about them. It is a fundamental part of adolescence. And it's one of the areas where we most fail young people as a culture, because we do not engage them in critical thinking about this most important thing that happens in their lives. And what we also know is that sexual minority young people, that a same-sex identity or orientation or same-sex behavior are associated with the risks for compromised emotional health. And today I will focus on emotional health. And I use the term sexual minority. Are people comfortable or are familiar with that term? We don't have good language culturally to talk about same-sex sexuality in our culture. So we talk about orientation, behavior, identity, and I use sexual minority as an umbrella term to encompass same-sex sexuality during growing up. And then, the important part, and the reason that many of us are here, is that most contemporary religious groups are ambivalent at best, or maybe not at best. There are, of course, affirming contemporary religious groups, but most are ambivalent or even negative and hostile towards same-sex sexuality. And so for today, I've become interested in what I want to talk about today is that what we know is that there's this big, strong link between same-sex sexual orientation and emotional health risk in adolescence, and I want to figure out what contribution religion may play in that. How can religion intervene and support sexual minority young people? In social sciences, we talk about religiosity, and then, you know, one of the things that you learn when you're almost 40 is that your mother was always right, because she had me look it up in the dictionary, because she was convinced that religiosity really I don't want to say negative, what would the right word be, pejorative connotation, particularly in a setting like this among people who talk about religion all the time. Social scientists use that word. I've changed it to religiousness, which I really just don't think is the right word for this, but this used to say religiosity last night, but now it says religiousness, because your mother is always right, or at least mine is, I don't know what yours. In terms of understanding religion in the lives of young people, many of you will say, well, the religion means can mean a lot of different things. And so I've been interested in what some social scientists, and perhaps this language will be corrected for me as well, but improved, it, public versus private religiousness or religiosity, meaning a personal sense of religion, my own sense of how important religion is to me and how faithful I am as a person, versus a public the public dimension of religion, which is being part of a faith community. And then there's religious affiliation. And what we know about all of these dimensions in the lives of young people is that religion is both an important personal experience as well as an important developmental context for young people. And all of the research on adolescence will show over and over again in general populations that religion is one of the most important protective factors against all of the risks that we know in the lives of young people, and is associated with all of the kind of positive things that we want for our young people, for our children to achieve. And the majority of US adolescents report being religious, and that religiousness is important to them. And that religiousness is strongly associated with emotional health. There's strong gender differences in religion. In both religion and emotional health, young women, and you probably all know this, young women are more likely to be religious. They're also more likely to report compromised emotional health, which is an interesting challenge. And so one of the questions that I came to this with is it religious identity? Is it the concept of private religion? Is it religious participation? Or is it religious affiliation that may be associated with emotional health of sexual minority young people? Or not? Or are there other more important things going on in the lives of sexual minority young people? In terms of sexual orientation and religion in adolescence, there are a couple ways that the folks who think and write about sexual minority young people have talked about religion and coping with religious prejudice. And I use those words, I was intentional about using the words religious prejudice because I think that's what it is. There are kind of three ways that most people talk about adolescents managing homophobia in the context of their faith. One way is to reject religion completely.
And I think most of us who are adults can, and are LGBT identified in one way or another, can think of the people in our lives that have chosen that as a way to manage. The second is compartmentalization of sexual identity and religious life, that we just live two different ways. We have our faith life, we have our identity, and we keep them separate. And I think that one thing that's important about this is that the research on sexual minority young people and adults will tell us that compartmentalization, I mean, we think, oh, well, how do you, you know, I think we kind of, it's easy to say, well, that, you know, how can you really do that? Is that really possible? And I think that what the religion on LGBT young people, what research on LGBT young people shows us is that gay young people are the masters at compartmentalization. What you learn, absolutely, you are trained as a child to compartmentalize that part of your life. To have your the emotional sexual identity part of yourself completely separate from the way that you live your life in your family, in your school, and in your faith community. So I want to just say, don't take this lightly, because I think it can happen. And I think that that's a real way that people manage. And then a third way to cope with religion is to integrate sexual identity and religious life. And I think that the exciting thing is that we see that happening more and more. And I see the time ticking away. What we know from the research on gay, lesbian, young people and religion, the very, very limited research, I mean, I was really actually surprised at how little has been thought about in this area, is that gay youth come out later, that there's a longer process for identifying same-sex sexuality for gay kids that are religious, that parents and family play a critical role, and that what so many gay young people will say and have said to me is that you really can't take the parent expectation, family expectation out of the faith experience. I mean, that it's one and the same. And that so much of the work of coming to terms with religion has to do with coming to terms with not being the young person that your parents had expected you to be, and not following the script, the life pattern that was anticipated for you and hoped for you. And I think it shouldn't be a surprise then to imagine risk in the lives of young people, since we know that a sense of hopelessness about being able to fulfill expectations of the people that are most important to you is really one of the largest risks in the lives of adolescents at all. I think the other thing is that there are possible gender differences, and there's a lot of discussion about this, but some suggest that this would work differently for gay men and lesbians, or for young men and women who are same-sex attracted. Or there's research to suggest that religion is more important in the lives of young women, and so would it mean that religion would be more important for the emotional health of young lesbians? Or gay men typically report more hostility from faith in their faith experience, and more prejudice from religious groups. So would this be a greater risk for young men? Well, we don't really know, and that's one of the things I'm interested in. And then I think the other potential issue is the potentially important role of religious affiliation in understanding and unpacking what's going on for sexual minority young people. I think that the challenge there is that there is significant diversity across, but also within, faith groups in terms of attitudes and feelings and support for same-sex sexuality. So some people would argue there's as much diversity within the Catholic faith as there is between the Catholics and the Methodists, for example. And certainly know that I think every single major faith organization in the United States has an LGBT affinity group of some sort in it, or associated with it. So the question would be, is affiliation even important anymore for understanding the role of religion in the lives of sexual minority young people? So I'm a little bit concerned about death by PowerPoint, which I have been accused of before. So I particularly wanted to get to this slide to share with you the questions that have motivated my research. And the first is to question whether compromised emotional health among sexual minority young people can be explained by religious experiences. And there are a lot of people who said, oh, it's got to be religion that is causing sexual minority young people to be at such risk. And then the second question is, given that, what is the role of religious affiliation? Because what comes out of the first question is that really religious experience may so depend on affiliation in the context of the group that you are affiliated with. There's no intrinsic reason why a personal feeling and sense of religiosity, religiousness, a sense of faith, there's no reason at all why that ought to be associated with risk just because a person is gay or lesbian, right? That makes no sense. There's no reason why being a part of a faith community ought to be risk for anyone unless that faith community is a hostile community. So the second question really looks is about unpacking that. Does religiousness depend on the context, the faith, the specific faith context? So Dad, who you otherwise know as Rollin, mentioned the National Longitudinal Study of Adolescent Health. And this just is quickly to show you about the National Study of Adolescent Health. So if you read in the newspaper something about, you know, a study of American teens, it's probably based on this study. Over 20,000 young people were included in this study. And it's important for a number of reasons, one of which is the amazing history of the study, which is that it began as the American Teenage Study and was blocked in, some of you may vaguely recall, in 1989, a huge controversy in the U.S. Senate about a teen sex study. And that was the American Teenage Study that was blocked by Senator Helms at the time because it included questions about same-sex sexuality. The history of science, well, and if ever there was a time to worry about political intervention in science, it's right now. If you've been following that, it's shocking what's happening. It's unbelievable what's happening. But this study is actually, people have written books about the history of this study because this study, we didn't have information about adolescent health for 30 years because of concerted efforts by people who did not want to know about the health and well-being of sexual minority young people in this country. It's an outrage. This is the first time, this is the first time we have national data, and it was began collected in 95. The first time. So the study was blocked in 89. It came back as the Adolescent Health Study, and the story behind the Ad Health, that name Ad Health, was that when they started saying, how do we save the study, people said, change it from the American Teen Study, Ad Health, just add health to the title. And it became known, I'm serious, that's the story. That's how it became known as the Adolescent Health Study. That's how they changed the name. The important thing about the study is that it's huge, that it's a representative study of young people across the nation, and that it included these two important questions. Have you ever had a romantic attraction to a male? Have you ever had a romantic attraction to a female? And what I'm showing you here is that many young people, 10% of the young people in the study, had not had a romantic attraction yet. These were 7th through 12th graders. Most of those are young kids. But that about 6%, around between 6 and 7%, reported a same-sex romantic attraction. The important thing you may also note is that depending on how you answer the questions, a lot of those same-sex attracted folks also reported attraction to the other sex. And so this study has been really important because it has offered some of the very first work on adolescent bisexuality. Or both sex, romantic attraction in adolescence. I am talking today, I'm combining those groups, which is a huge no-no in my book scientifically, but because I'm going to be looking at religious denomination, I'm combining the groups to maintain the number of numbers that would be required to do the kind of analysis that I'm doing. But I will note that what the research, what my work and others is beginning to show is that that young adolescent bisexuals are among those that seem to be absolutely most at risk for behavioral health risk. And it's really this results of mine and results from some other folks from some other state-based studies that are really propelling people to start asking, what is that about? Because we have no theory, human developmental human sexuality theory for understanding the development of bisexuality in adolescence. So the measures of religiosity or religiousness include, in terms of public, include a frequency of attending religious services and youth group meetings, and the private religiousness is importance of religion and frequency of prayer. So young people answer these four questions. A number of other people have been using this. The public religious questions are very highly correlated. Young people who go to church are also likely to go to youth group, and the private dimensions are highly correlated with one another as well. Young people who pray and who say that religious is important to them. And then in terms of religious, and there was another important question, which is that I've created a category for born again that I call born again. They were asked, one question was, do you think of yourself as born again? That was asked only of Christians. And then the other question was, do you agree or disagree that the sacred scriptures of your religion are the word of God and are completely without any mistakes? And those are almost overlapping. I've categorized young people who answered affirmatively to either one of those questions, and I call them born again as a shorthand for understanding what that group would be. I should now say that what I've done in terms of religious affiliation, this is now shifting into a study really of Christian experience in the lives of adolescents, because less than 1% of the young people that responded to the Ad Health study reported some other faith affiliation that was not Christian. But this is the 12% reported no religion, so that they reported no religion. And this shows you the frequency for the full sample of religious affiliation of young people in the study. The other Protestant group, just so you know, is a strange group, because they asked the question, Christian church, disciples of Christ. And you might guess that among teenagers, lots of kids filled in Christian church, disciples of Christ. And my father pointed out to me that there was probably no way that 10% of American teenagers were members of the Christian church, disciples of Christ. So that is, they are, that group is in the other Protestant group. And so this group will want to know who was who. And this is the way that I categorized those groups, and we could have lots of conversations. Actually, Dad and I had lots of conversations about this. And I should even have the reference here, but actually it's in my bag. I can tell you if you really need to know. I learned much more about how people group religious Christian denominations than I ever imagined I would ever know. And so I didn't just totally make this up. This is based on research of other sociologists of religion. So I want to show that to you, because I figure you might be interested in how these groups are defined, liberal versus mainline Protestant, evangelical conservative, and other. So quickly, because I'm so terribly out of time, is that I want to examine religious group differences and ask those research questions. I'm going to plug ahead. The first thing is does religious affiliation, is there a difference for sexual minority young people? Because it could be that your religious affiliation would allow you the ability to imagine yourself as attracted to the same sex. And what I found is interesting is that for boys, same-sex attraction is equally likely across all groups. But for young women, the one exception was that for girls that report no religion are also more likely to say that they have a same-sex attraction. So that's interesting. What does it mean? Well, perhaps it means that there's that it's possible to that it, without a, with no religious affiliation, it's impossible to imagine that for yourself and to acknowledge that for yourself if you're a young woman. There were no sexual orientation differences in public religion. Makes kind of sense to me. For the most part, young people go to church with their families for the most part, and so there's maybe no reason to think that young people would attend church more or less often based on their sexual orientation or identity. But then there's kind of some interesting stuff that happens when the mouse works. For private religion, a sense of oneself as religious, this is consistent. This shows the other sex-attracted kids in the study, the heterosexual kids. Young women report more sense of religion, sense of importance of religion, than young men do, 10% more, basically 63 versus 52%. And what's interesting is if we look at the sexual minority kids in the study, they're right in between. And so it's an interesting double group difference. Girls score higher. Same-sex attracted boys and girls are equal to each other, but boys, same-sex attracted boys are more religious than their heterosexual peers. Same-sex attracted girls are less religious than their heterosexual peers. Very interesting. What's that about? And it may tell us something about, let's talk about what that's about. I'm interested to hear what you think that might be about. I'm interested in getting the mouse to work. In terms of the percent that are born again, there was an interesting difference here as well, which is that about two-thirds of the young people in the United States report being born again, which I was sort of surprised by. And for sexual minority boys, they look about the same. There's no statistical difference there. But what's interesting is that sexual minority girls are much less likely to say that they were born again. Significantly less likely, like 10% less likely than other girls to say that they were born again. So the story here, just quickly, is just that there seems to be some religiousness differences for same-sex attracted girls, but there don't seem to be strong differences for boys. And on emotional health, same-sex attracted kids report higher anxiety and depression, and same-sex attracted girls report compromised self-esteem. And there is not a self-esteem difference for same-sex attracted boys. That first question, and how many of you saw the article in the Lancaster paper, because maybe you've already seen my results, so the dramatic foreshadowing of the results, but the first question was, does compromised emotional health among sexual minority youth, can it be explained by religious experience? And what I'm not showing you is the statistical regression models, and I can explain that afterwards if you'd like, but the quick answer is, well, not really. That religious experience or religious affiliation of the young person or our mother, and I didn't get into moms, but we do have data on mother's religion, doesn't account for sexual orientation differences in emotional health. So you can't explain the difference through religion. It's not religion that is causing emotional health challenges for young people. There's an effect, but it can't fully explain what's going on for sexual minority young people. And so then the question for me has, the second question then was, perhaps it may be because, in part, that might be, because religiousness may depend on affiliation. And so that was the next. And the important thing here, the quick results, are that for sexual minority boys, emotional health risk varies across faith groups. And this is really not what it's not really what I'd expected. I'd expected that religious experience would make a difference for explaining emotional health risk. I didn't think that most of the power would have to do with faith affiliation. And so it's an interesting position to be in to try to explain these results to, for example, Catholics when you see the results that I'll show you next. For sexual minority girls, there does seem to be some indication that that emotional health is dependent on religious affiliation, and I'll talk about that quickly. So for boys, the biggest difference for self-esteem seems to have to do with being Catholic. The Catholic sexual minority boys report lower self-esteem. The same is true for anxiety. Catholic boys report higher anxiety. There's an interesting thing here where liberal Protestant boys, sexual minority boys report lower anxiety, which is seems to be some good news. And then for depression, born-again sexual minority boys report higher depression, and affiliation is important, so that mainline Protestant, Catholic, and Baptist sexual minority boys report higher depression. So there's some nodding, and this is one of the, cases where it's the sociologist telling you the obvious, maybe. It's unfortunate that it might be obvious to people or that that would be explainable. But clearly there's something going on for boys and for being Catholic and being a sexual minority, being same-sex attracted, across all of the outcomes, all three of these outcomes anyway. And there's some indication maybe that being a liberal Protestant would be protective, at least in terms of anxiousness. And for girls, the interesting thing is, the really important point about for girls is that there's no difference for sexual minority girls. Religion doesn't make a difference for anxiety and for self-esteem, which is really remarkable given that religion is such a strong influence on the anxiety and self-esteem of girls in the general population. So it's like it's not there for And maybe it's the compartmentalization, I don't know, but it's like it's not, there's no strong link at all to anything but depression. And for depression, what's really going on is dependent on affiliation. The Catholic and Baptist sexual minority girls, like boys, are more likely to be depressed. And then this interesting, the one time where this thing worked, where something would be dependent on affiliation, had to do with being mainline Protestant, that mainline Protestant sexual minority girls are less depressed if they attend church. And I think that's interesting. It's not if they don't attend, it's if they do attend. And I think it's about, I think what we would, the sociologist would say, that it's about being connected, being part of a faith community. So, in summary, religiousness doesn't fully account for sexual orientation differences in emotional health at the general population level, and really that it doesn't do a lot of there doesn't seem to be a big degree to which it's dependent on religious affiliation, except for anxiety for mainline Protestant sexual minority girls. But the sobering results seem to have to really do with religious affiliation, and particularly for sexual minority boys. And I think that, wow, you know, what do we do about that? That's an interesting question. I think that that if religious affiliation matters, well, this is what we can talk about over lunch, maybe. You know, why does it matter for sexual minority boys in a way that's not true for girls? And then the other question that I have, I think, is that does religion matter less somehow for sexual minority girls, and if so, why? Why are they this unique group that is less likely to be born again? They're less likely to say that religion is important to them. You know, what is that about? So I think when I thought about concluding, you know, it's an interesting week. People ask me a lot, you know, well, the thing I get most asked is will a queer eye for a straight guy make a difference for gay kids? That's the first question I usually get. And I don't have a television. I don't have a television. So I've never seen it. So I can't really make an expert opinion at this point. But I think the other things that are going on in addition to queer eye for a straight guy are that Tuesday, the Massachusetts Supreme Court handed down an unbelievable, amazing, it's one of those, like, who would have thought in our lifetime kinds of things. And also, who would have thought in our lifetime that the President of the United States would declare October 12th to 18th Marriage Protection Week? How many of you knew that? It's outrageous. Am I allowed to say that from the pulpit? It is unbelievable. It is unbelievable. As if we could get married, as if marriage needed protection, and as if we didn't already know that they really, really, really don't like us. Like, okay, now we get that. Now we really, you know, we really, really, really mean that we don't like you. So we're going to have a week to pronounce that we don't like you. So it's an amazing time of change. And I actually am not a pessimist. I'm a realist. I think. I think what this means now, the Massachusetts decision means that now we're really going to the war is going to begin. And I think that on the large scale, there's no going back, and I think it's signs of progress, and I think if we imagine that we could have even had this discussion 20 years ago, I think we can all acknowledge that there's amazing progress. But at the person level, I'm very worried, and this is the charge to you. At times like this, at times of change, are associated with increased violence against LGBT people, and particularly against children. And so for youth, I think we'll see that as the possibilities for understanding oneself as a sexual minority person, as a gay, lesbian, bisexual, transgender person, are continually expanding. As that becomes more and more possible, the challenges for individual kids in their everyday life are going to increase too. And I'm really worried about that. So what's the role of the church? What's the role of supportive faith communities? Well, I think at both of those levels, there's the sort of large-scale social level, and then there's the personal level. And I think at the personal level, it's more important than ever that we engage in our congregations discussions with young people about what it means to be a person of faith and what it means to be LGBT queer. We like to think that young people aren't aware of these debates and controversies around them, and it's just not true. Young people know it's happening. They know the contention is there, and we as adults typically fail them on the most important issues in their lives to really engage them. And then at the public level, I mean, I'm not the one to speak about it, I guess. Well, I mean, who is? So it may as well be me. But churches need to engage, you know, contemporary churches need to reclaim the national debate about what it means to be a person of faith and what it means to be queer. It needs to be done. Somebody needs to do it. How do we do it? Well, that's, I guess, what everybody here is trying to figure out. So I'm willing to help, but I don't have the answer to that. But then I think back to the person level, and then I'll quit. I think that the thing not to forget is that young people are going to lead this if we don't. How many of you know something or work in the public education system or have a kid that went to the public schools? For those of you who know about what's going on in the school system, the schools are changing, and it's happening. And the adults, I can tell you lots and lots of stories about rural California, and don't write me off because I'm from California, because, Susanville, California doesn't seem very different to me than Grand Junction, Colorado. And young people are leading the change, and adults are fighting to catch up. And if I had to predict in terms of where we're headed next, I would say that that's going to happen in the faith community, as it already has started to happen, that young people are going to challenge all of us as adults to make it real for them in their faith context. And so how do we do that? And so I'm glad, Tim, that you're here to figure out how we're going to make it real with young people. So thanks. So why don't we have conversation? We have a little bit of time. There was one way in the back.
You mentioned a lot about the role of the church in the lives of the young people that are members of the church, that are affiliated with the church. I know that in my own experience growing up, I kind of felt like the church was something you can't run away from. And I'm wondering what effects, whether your study suggests any impact of the church on folks who aren't affiliated with the church, what their responses are about what religion has to do with how easy it is to come out, how easy it is to self-identify.
Yeah. I think it's huge, and I can't show you. It's not part of what I've done with the national study. I have been engaged in a study of gay-straight alliances in high schools and junior high schools in California and in the West, and spent a lot of time talking with queer kids about what's going on in their schools. And religion is always part of the conversation about what's going on in schools. And so I've had one young person say, I go to this church where, you know, gay people are just part of the church, and it just, you know, it burns me to think that this is not, you know, what's wrong with my school that it's not an open place. So there are good stories, but that's the one. For all the other stories of kids saying, this is such a, you know, conservative, fundamentalist town, and when you talk with them, it's not particularly their experience. They may be Latino and Catholic, and they're not. It's not. They're for them. It's invisibility. It's just not there. At least in the context of their experience of their church. Now, certainly they're aware of the bigger issues going around the Catholic Church outside them. But yeah, I mean, clearly it does. I think that we haven't begun to be able to figure out how to study it. But I think you're absolutely. I think your point is an important one. Here's a question.
A few weeks ago in the paper, New York, I think it was considered an all-gay high school. I was wondering if you think that's helpful as
yeah.
To get out of the intergender society.
Right. Harvey Milk High School in New York City. That's had a lot of controversy, and that's actually maybe the second question that I get asked after Queer Eye for a Straight Guy. I get asked about Harvey Milk High. The important thing about Harvey Milk High School is that it's been there for 20 years, and it's changing its status. Harvey Milk High School has been a high school for gay lesbian kids in New York City for a long time, so it's kind of interesting that we're having arguments about Harvey Milk High School right now. I think Harvey Milk is really an important example of the utter failure of public education for gay lesbian kids. So certainly one would hope that we would not have to have Harvey Milk High School, but I've been to Harvey Milk High, and there's no question that it's an important place that's needed. And so I don't have a good answer to that, because I would like to think we didn't need it. I would also like to think that the experiences that all the young people that attend that school tell about what their public school experience was like weren't true. And given that, I don't think we have a choice but to protect some kids. We could go on and on about that, but so I'd be interested to hear what you think about it. But thanks for asking the question. Yeah.
I'm just wondering your statistics that you reported here from the ad study seem to be touching on more of the mainline type of churches. Was there any investigation as to results of young people, like you mentioned earlier, who attended a church that was open and affirming, or an MCC type church, or New Life, but there's so many different
right.
Church congregation of being accepted. Has that reflected on religious labor?
Right. I don't know of anybody who's been able to do that kind of research. The interesting thing about this is that in fiddling with how to categorize faith groups, I did analysis that included the United Church of Christ, the Unitarian Universalists, and the Quaker. MCC is not one of the was not one of the options in 1995 that was on the Ad Health study. Well, you know, the Ad Health study also didn't make it possible to have same-sex parents. Kids, it just wasn't even one of the things that kids could say was going on in their lives, which is just tells you the degree to which we have to push the researchers in terms of their understanding and thinking. But when I grouped those three groups, the UCC, the Unitarian Universalist, and the Quakers, there were no difference. The results looked no different than these. I think that what we probably need, there are a lot of people that do studies of Catholic kids, so we probably need people to be doing studies of children that grow up in progressive faith communities. And who's going to do that? That's a great, we need to do that. Yeah, thanks. Maybe in a couple more, one or two more questions, and then we'll go have lunch. Any other? I don't know. There may be people here who know better than I about that specifically, but I don't know of any that study, you know, kids who are no longer have an affiliation. There's some people that have done research among gay adults about, you know, what made you no longer go to your church. But I think, I mean, my comment on that, I do the youth development thing a lot, and I talk with a lot of folks, and I think that, you know, this is an issue that if the church could get right on, young people would be right on. There's no question. Sexuality is the social justice issue for this generation of young people. Call them the whatever we're calling them, the millennials is what some folks are now calling this new group. Sexual justice is the issue. I'm actually worried that young people seem to be able to talk more about sexual justice than they are about race and ethnic justice and social class justice. But for whatever reasons, sexuality is a motivator for young people. And we have abdicated any kind of leadership as adults in all of the major institutions in their lives for thinking about and talking critically about sex. It's just the media. The media is leading the way. And we need to catch up. And I would predict that as is what's happening in schools, that, you know, that sexuality issues are becoming full front in the middle of the issues around schools, that, you know, if churches can and do take it on, you'll see young people becoming engaged in a way that you've never seen before. That's my prediction. Thanks. Well, maybe we should go to lunch. Thanks.